Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortez Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts. This is your Scoop for the week of May 27th to the 31st. Last weekend, the Town of Smithers Recreation Coordinator Lauren Allen was working with the Bulkley Valley Disc Golf Association to raise awareness for Accessibility Week in Canada. And if you've ever wondered what the Smaliach word for disc golf was, stay tuned to The Scoop today to learn that from my interview with Saltwater Hank. And fashion shows are so last year. This year in Revelstoke, a group of fashion-forward environmentalists held a trashin' show in Revelstoke's downtown. Stoke FM's Melissa Jameson has that scoop. Cortez Island is finally getting a real pump truck for this year's forest fire season, and even one with four-wheel drive. Learn about the island's fire season with Lonnie Taylor today on The Scoop. But first, from CIFR in Prince George, Ian Gregg sat down with the PGMLA to talk about deforestation and who specifically is responsible for enacting real change for the climate.
The costs and expenses associated with emergency management have increased in the province of British Columbia over the past few years. For example, the BC Wildfire Service in 2021 had 1,781 personnel listed. By the 2023 season, there is a 55.6% increase in full-time permanent staff since the 2021 season, with 568 full-time permanent and 1,592 seasonal, for a total of 2,160 personnel. To get an idea of the big picture, we went into conversation with the MLA for the Prince George Mackenzie District, Mike Morris. We take you now to our recorded conversation from his constituency office in Prince George, BC.
It is a good investment. It's a fraction of the investment that BC should be making in wildfire prevention. And wildfire prevention is a broader topic than just trying to put out a fire. You need the infrastructure in place in order to do that. Are the fleets of aircraft that we have enough? Are they the right kind of aircraft? Why aren't we doing more night firefighting with night vision capabilities and hiring the crew that's capable of doing that? So there's a number of things that we need to do there. But this is something that British Columbia should have looked at a long time ago, because it's been exacerbated by the forest practices that we've had in play over the last several decades. Clear-cutting, for an example, has led to where we are today with the loss of forest cover, the frequency of magnitude of flooding, which dries out the watershed in turn, and the planting of the conifer plantations that we have are so dense and so thick.
The concept of prevention actually goes back quite a while. We're not just talking about putting out a fire before it reaches a settlement or municipality, etc. It's about the greater forestry practices and firefighting practices that we've engaged in over the last, 70 plus years or so on. Is that right?
It is. That's correct. So we've done a lot of clear cutting in the province that has led us to where we are here today. And the amount of infrastructure that we need to fight forest fires, the water bombers, the helicopters, the men and women on the ground, the equipment that we need, as we lose forest canopy, and we have more drying out of the watersheds, we need to increase the amount of infrastructure that we have. So it's commensurate. So when we decrease something on one side that causes fires and floods, then we need to increase the assets on the other side to help prevent them or help fight them. Preventing is going to be a massive undertaking in rehabilitation of the landscape. So we've got a couple of decades, several decades ahead of us to get to that point where we can mitigate fires.
What department of the government or what areas could actually begin that work and start putting feet on the ground to perform that activity?
There'll be two streams here, and I think the private sector will be heavily involved. Forestry is going to to have to change their focus on how we do business. We're still going to have forestry in BC, but we don't have those big trees anymore. But we need to go in and as quickly as possible, and it will still take us a couple of decades to do that, thin out these monoculture conifer managed forests that we have throughout the province of 20 million hectares and get it down to a reasonable number, and science has been working on that. At the same time, we need to build up our wildfire services and get to work there, and also to get our communities more involved in that. Our communities know better what to do on the ground than a lot of other people do. We have contractors on the ground that have equipment available, and they can be out there, Johnny, on the spot to put something out. We don't need to go through all that bureaucracy and that red tape and all the unnecessary things that we do that delay an immediate response to a wildfire.
And when we're looking at that worst case scenario where a disaster has struck and now we're in the rebuilding process, even though the BC provincial government doesn't front the entire expense of reconstruction, and neither does the federal government, even though the federal government kicks in a bit typically, despite the fact that the government doesn't front the entire cost of reconstruction, does that still outweigh the cost of the prevention, essentially, would you say?
It will, for sure it will, just because we've gone so far without including some kind of a preventive mechanism in place with how we've done business over the years. But that's government's responsibility. It will take a lot of resources to rebuild, and it will take a lot of resources to prevent loss of life. And that's what the focus should be, is loss of life, and then infrastructure secondary to that. But to have the necessary resources in there to protect a community and make sure that the lives are evacuated and well taken care of. And at the same time, there's another body of resources that go in to try and mitigate the infrastructure losses that we have there. But, you know, I was listening to a representative from the Canadian Insurance Bureau speaking about the cause of wildfires and the cause of floods. And he made an interesting comment, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but he made a comment, the fact that, can we really call the loss of infrastructure caused by wildfire or floods an accident when we know what the cause is? And that should have been a warning for governments and industry, because there will be some civil liability on industry as well if they are continuing on doing these practices when we know there was a cause, or they are the cause to fires and floods. So if that's the case, taxpayers are on the hook, and there may be a requirement for federal and provincial governments to look at a government insurance program for homeowners that are ultimately in these regions where insurance companies won't cover it anymore. So that could be another responsibility for governments moving forward until over the next few decades we can rebuild the natural infrastructure of forests and mitigate a lot of the fires and floods that take place moving forward here. But that's, we are several decades away from being able to do that.
Category 2 and Category 3 fire bans enacted in the Vancouver Island region, and that includes Cortez Island. I caught up with Eli McKenty, the fire chief for Cortez Island, to find out about these restrictions. What region of Vancouver Island or the coast?
So we're the Coastal Fire Center, which I believe is all of Vancouver Island, as well as like the Sunshine Coast and some of the area around Vancouver. So it's a fairly large area. This is why last year we actually had the ban lift for a week or two once it had been put on, and it caused quite a bit of concern on Cortez because we were still quite dry up here. But a lot of the larger Coastal Fire Center had gotten rain, and they had determined that overall the fire danger had reduced enough to remove the ban. So actually that's one thing that the regional district has been working on, is creating a local open burning bylaw, which would mean that in cases like that, we would be able to implement a ban for Cortez if the province lifted it for the whole Coastal Fire Center.
I'm so glad you brought up last year and that history, because that was different and very notable, since Cortez doesn't have the elevation of our surrounding neighbors. We don't always get the same precipitation.
Yeah, many areas in the province, they look at snowpack to determine drought conditions and so on. And since we don't really have any snowpack here, it's more about overall rainfall. And I think we were reasonably close to normal, but as far as I could tell, it seemed a little bit drier. But as far as our fire season, it's really going to depend.
So I know, luckily, in February, Sadhu Johnston, the president of the Cortez Fire Department, he made some announcements at a public cooperative event that involved the SECA and the Village Commons Cortez Foundation around some improvements that are coming for Cortez or have already come for the fire department. Is there anything you wanted to mention there that has just been completed or that we have now?
Yeah, we have lots of stuff going on right now. We've done quite well with grant funding in the past year, and we were able to purchase about $50,000 worth of additional wildfire and structural protection equipment this spring, which is all in service now. And we also have upgraded our water storage tanks at both fire halls, and we have a third water site on the south end. And we are also getting a new pumper truck to replace our very old engine 101 from the Manson's Fire Hall. So lots of exciting stuff going on.
When does the new pumper truck arrive?
The pumper truck is en route from Kentucky right now. We actually have a department member driving it out, and I think he's expecting to be in Campbell River around the 23rd, where we'll have radios and decals put on and have a commercial vehicle inspection, and hopefully it'll be in service by the end of the month.
Just in time.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long has it been? How old is the old one?
The one that we're replacing is from 1986. So it's a few years old now, and we've actually been looking at replacing it for several years now. And we're replacing it with a four-wheel drive pumper. It's a 2013 Pierce International pumper and should be quite suitable for Cortez roads and driveways.
Is the current one not four-wheel drive?
No, currently our rescue truck and our wildfire truck are four-wheel drive, but none of the other trucks.
Lonnie Taylor, CKTZ News, Cortez Island. CKTZ News is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, the program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
It's Saturday evening, and part of the 100 block of 2nd Street West in Revelstoke has been transformed into a fashion show runway. Instead of parked cars, rows of chairs are lined up on either side of the street. A DJ plays upbeat music as the crowd begins to trickle in. People chat with one another, their anticipation building until finally it's time for the models to showcase the hard work of this year's designers. Except, this isn't your typical fashion show. That's because at the Trashin' Show, all of the outfits are made of materials meant for the land. Models walk, or in some cases strut, down the runway in outfits made from old burlap sacks, coffee bags, used dog food bags, recycled thread, plastic, and other material you probably wouldn't associate with Vogue Creations. Normally held in April to celebrate Earth Month, this year's Trashin' Show took place May 25th in partnership with another environmentally focused event, Revy ReFest. The Trashin' Show featured 12 outfits and 15 participants, including both models and designers. Unlike previous years, this year's Trashin' Show did not include a contest and no winner was announced. Kate Baruch, one of the organizers, said instead, the intention this year was to create an event where designers could showcase their outfits and the community could gather and enjoy the vibes of the Revy ReFest weekend. I had a chance to sit down with Baruch a few days ahead of this year's Trashin' Show to talk about its history and how it helps share the value of environmentalism with the community. Here's the interview. Can you sort of give an overview what the Trashin' Show is for anyone that's listening that doesn't know and sort of how it got its start in Revelstoke?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2017, Sarah Sansom, who is the founder and creative director at Birch and Lace, she started the Trashin' Show as a fundraiser for a local nonprofit called the North Columbia Environmental Society. I was working with them at the time, and so that's how I started to get involved with them. So Birch and Lace had always, as part of its ethos, had a really great waste diversion program. We are partnered with a company called Green Circle Salons, and we divert a lot of our salon-specific waste through Green Circle, and that includes things like hair clippings, hair color, metals, and single-use waste associated with the spa. To date, in 2024, we've already recycled and diverted 200 pounds of salon and spa specific waste from the landfill. And we're only, we're barely through May. So that's a great accomplishment. So yeah, the Birch and Lace ethos had always kind of had this like waste diversion component with it. And as a result of that, we were looking for a way to raise awareness in the community about reusability and recycling and sustainable living. And we wanted to do it in kind of like a really fun and engaging way. And so the Trashin Show was born. And then the idea of Trashin is it's not new. We didn't invent it. Trashin combines the idea of like turning trash into fashion and creating some sort of awareness around the topics of waste diversion and reusability and sustainable living. And it presents it in a really fun and creative community event, which I think has always been a big hit, especially in Revelstoke.
How does the Trashin Show help to share that value of environmentalism within the broader community context?
So historically, the Trashin Show event was hosted as a fundraiser. And so we would ask participants, designers would have to pay an entrance fee to come and watch the show. There would be a fee associated with that. And then we would have like a big silent auction or a 50-50 raffle. All of these kind of fundraising efforts were made to help offset the cost of creating this event and, you know, giving back to the community. And like I had mentioned initially, the Trashin Show event was put on as a fundraiser for the North Columbia Environmental Society. And then eventually, you know, we raised money for the food bank last year. And this year we're joining forces with the ReFest events. And I think just hosting it under that umbrella is going to bring so much more engagement through the community, because Revelstoke ReFest already has established themselves as an event for the community about sustainable living and reusability and, you know, mending as opposed to throwing out. So this event is like a really nice encapsulation of the ReFest into like one kind of creative event.
Are there any sort of outfits or pieces that are sort of memorable and stand out to you over the years?
Oh gosh, there's a few crowd favorites for sure. And we've had participants in the event that have done it year after year after year. Like one participant comes to mind, and they've been a part of the event since 2017. And every year they come up with another great outfit in collaboration with their mom. And this year they're doing it again, but they're bringing their dog. Like we're, you know, there's always some sort of element of evolution, which is always so exciting to see. But a standout outfit for me would be the winner of last year was like there was like a dress made out of coffee filters and wine corks, which was really stunning. I have to say that a lot of the designer and model combinations are like co-workers, they're parent and kid combos, they're friends, they're, you know, they're partners. They're just like, there's so much room for like joy to come out of this event.
For 92.5 Stoke FM in Revelstoke, I'm Melissa Jamieson.
Sunday, May 26th marked the beginning of Accessibility Week in Canada. The aim of Accessibility Awareness Week is to celebrate diverse abilities and reflect on how we can make our communities accessible to all people. I went to Ranger Park in Smithers to speak with the Town of Smithers Recreation Coordinator Lauren Allen, who is promoting the accessibility of disc golf. Disc golf is a game much like golf in that you tee off from a pad and want to get your disc to the destination, which is called the basket, in the fewest throws or strokes possible. Throwing a disc into the basket makes a very satisfying sound. Lauren was working with Ben Anderson and Glenn Ingram, who represent the Bulkley Valley Disc Golf Association, to promote the game and invite people to play it with their eyes closed or ears plugged, or use their non-dominant hand, and also to throw while sitting in a wheelchair. Here's Lauren Allen speaking about why disc golf was a good fit for this accessibility event.
Hi, my name is Lauren Allen. I'm the recreation coordinator with the town of Smithers.
Tell me what people are walking up and seeing today.
Okay, so today we have Accessibility Awareness Week, and we're launching it with a collaboration with Smithers Disc Golf. Mm-hmm. And essentially what we're going to be doing today is playing in other people's shoes. So learning how to play disc golf in different perspectives. So the four activities that we're going to be doing today is vision impaired throws. We're going to be doing earplugs, yep, throws, wrong arm throws, and then sitting in a wheelchair throws into the disc baskets.
Is this the first year that this has happened, or is this
something
that's continuing?
Yeah, and this is happening right now simultaneously across Canada, just to launch off Accessibility Awareness Week. So it's starting today.
When people come and they want to play, is the kind of aim for this to just bring a little perspective?
Yeah,
or can you yet build
perspective, build awareness, and also help support the disc golf society here.
I
think it's great what you guys are doing, and it'd be awesome to get more people involved and just bring an awareness to the course as well. But yeah, mostly is to play in other people's shoes, so really learn different perspectives.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
You're welcome.
Okay, yeah, talk to me about what's in your hand here.
Okay, so for vision impaired, we have it's called a Meep tracker.
Yeah.
And it's for tracking where your disc golf goes.
Okay, it's a sticky little disc.
I don't know what to call this.
Yeah, like a battery, like a appendage.
It's a tracker that attaches to your disc. Yeah, and then this is the sound that it makes here once it connects. Okay, so what this does is it's an app that you can get called Meep on your phone, and then once it connects to the battery that's attached to the disc, it just helps for people to find where their disc went.
Also on Sunday at Ranger Park, I caught up with Will Uxbatska Galau, or Jeremy Paul, who just released his second Smolyak's language rock album called Sipinsk, under the name Saltwater Hank. This record came out on Saturday, May 25th, and Jeremy unleashed it in Prince George, where he cut his teeth as a young artist in a band called Gibao. Jeremy is working to bring Smolyak's to more people through his work with the Tsimshian Culture Society and his music. So now let's go to my brief chat with Jeremy Paul of Saltwater Hank.
So we are putting this album out. It's a bunch of songs that we've been doing live for a while. I guess in November we recorded it down in the Okanagan at a friend of mine's analog studio. There's no computers in that studio. It's all this tape. And we just did it live off the floor, fresh off of a tour, which was like really great because we were tight after the tour and then just went straight into the studio, did a bunch of stuff. It was mostly second take that we got things done. Mm-hmm. And yeah, now we got it on a vinyl record and it's good to go. It's definitely more of a rock and roll progression from the last record, mm-hmm, which had a lot of country elements. This one's just straight ahead rock and roll, all in some Aliyah language.
Can you tell me the name of the album?
Sipinsk.
And what does that mean?
Love.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who did the album art for it?
That's my cousin, Kelly Clifton. Her real name's Adjiksim Gipaik. And she's also from partly based. She's Tsimshian, really heavily involved in the language as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's quite a good fit.
I guess just one last thing, if you want to maybe, do you want to do just a little update on how the Smolyak's immersion program is going as well?
Yeah, which is actually how I got to take off here pretty much immediately because we're doing an event tonight. We're launching a household fluency program where we're pairing up like a group of elders with a couple of different families to get them as fluent as they can in the language. And the thing with these families is they have very young children who are also learning the language. That's the path that we're choosing to go, and it's
intergenerational and
and when a language is spoken at home, it sticks. It's just the research shows it, real life experience shows it, so we're trying that. It's a pilot project and we're just, today's the launch.
What's the word for disc golf? What's the Smolyak word for disc golf?
I was trying to think of how that would be. It would be like nugga will oi, would be like you gotta throw it long.
Sweet.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's cool.
But the disc itself, it's got to be like a circular flying thing.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, I've got that recorded. We can learn it now. Yeah. Jeremy, I know you're busy, so thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
All right. Yeah, thank you so much.
And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC,
by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenai, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.